Enough chit-chat. My name is Tim Knepper. I teach philosophy and religion here at Drake University, and I direct the Comparison Project, which is hosting the event tonight. The Comparison Project is an experimental effort in a philosophy of religion, which is historically grounded and religiously diverse. If you want to know exactly what that means, stop me afterwards and ask me. For now, we'll roll onward. The Comparison Project is generally supported by six funders, Drake University's Humanities Center, Drake University's Principal Financial Group Center for Global Citizenship, Humanities Iowa, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, Cultivating Compassion, the Richard Deming Foundation, and the Medbury Fund. And although I don't need to know you, although I don't even need to tell you, I do need to tell you that the opinions expressed here do not necessarily reflect those of these supporters. One of our supporters encourages us to take attendance at these events. I'll be sending around an attendance sign-up sheet in just a moment. If you'd be so kind, just to sign your name at least. And if you want to be added to our emailing list or to Humanities Iowa's emailing list, there's a place there that you can check and provide us with your email address. We also have some brochures out back about the Comparison Project. This is the penultimate, the second to last event of our 2012-2013 season. Our last event will be, 3 weeks from yesterday, on May 7th. We're inviting three philosophers of religion to compare over all the data, so to speak, that we've collected for the year. That should be an exciting event, and we get three different perspectives on what the Comparison Project has done this year. I hope you'll come out for that. But as I said, there are brochures in the back which will tell you more about the Comparison Project, and there are also evaluation sheets out back. We urge you to give us constructive feedback, some criticism, so we know how to do better. Okay, we're pleased tonight to have with us Garion Kopf from Luther College in upstate northeastern Iowa, and I'm even more pleased to introduce to a colleague of mine, Leah Kalmanson, who's a personal friend of Garion's and who recommended Garion for tonight's talk. Leah is going to be introducing Garion. So if you please welcome Leah Kalmanson. Thank you.
I've never been at the mic before in this room. Thanks everyone for coming out tonight. I'm happy to see lots of my students here. And I'm very excited today to get to introduce my friend and colleague, Dr. Garion Kopf. I have long been a fan of his work, and so I'm really happy to have the opportunity to welcome him to Drake this evening. Dr. Kopf received his PhD from Temple University and is currently professor of Asian and Comparative Religion at Luther College. He is a research fellow of the Japan Foundation and the Japan Society for the Promotion of Science, through which he conducted research in 93 and 94, at Ogden University in Machida, and from 2002 to 2004 at the Nanzan Institute for Religion and Culture in Nagoya, Japan. He's also affiliated with the University of Hong Kong, where he taught at the Center for Buddhist Studies in 2008 and 2009. Garion is the author of the book, Beyond Personal Identity, Dogen, Nishida, and the Phenomenology of No Self, and he's the co-editor of the collection Rogyakantian Buddhism. He's also founder and editor of the Journal of Buddhist Philosophy. Garion's work is rooted in Japanese and comparative philosophy and Buddhist studies. And in these fields, he's asking challenging questions about globalization, cultural pluralism, cross-cultural dialogue. He's published far too many articles on these issues for me to read you a full list here, so I'll restrict myself to just a few. Ambiguity, diversity, and an ethics of understanding, what Nishida's philosophy can contribute to the pluralism debate in the journal Culture and Dialogue. Between Identity and Difference, Three Ways of Reading Nishida's Non-Dualism in the Japanese Journal of Religious Studies. Neither Good Nor Evil, a Non-Dualistic Ethics for Today in Frontiers of Japanese Philosophy. And these are just the English language titles. Garion is also well published in German and Japanese. Tonight, he will be speaking to us on the topic of Buddhism and the ethics of memory. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Varian Hope.
Thank you very much for the warm welcome. Full introductions by Dr. Kepner and by Dr. Carmenson. It's my pleasure and privilege to be here today in the series, comparative study series, and to talk to you about the connection between Buddhism and ethics of memory. The title which I've given to the talk is Suffering, Memory, and Compassion, a Buddhist variation on the ethics of memory. The project that I'm working on actually brings together two interests I have. The first one is to develop an ethics out of the basic texts and ideas and philosophies of the Zen Buddhist tradition. And the second one is to actually apply it very concretely to contemporary issues that have to do with intercultural communication, intercultural exchange. As a German who has studied in the United States, who has chosen Japanese philosophy as his field, who lived in Japan and taught about Japanese Buddhism, taught Japanese Buddhism in China, in Hong Kong and Shanghai, so that the intercultural dimension is extremely important to my work, practically but also so personally. And that's what I would like to talk about today, and that's what I'd like to come up with a framework that is not given by specific Buddhist thinkers in the past, but that I developed out of Japanese Buddhist, mostly Zen philosophy. The case I'm going to talk about today is the Nanjing Massacre. And there are two reasons for me to get into that. The first one is that with all the discussions about the various larger event and catastrophes that humanity has produced. In the United States, the Nanjing Massacre is not necessarily one that is talked about a lot. But the way I got into it was when I was teaching Japanese Buddhism for 1 year in Hong Kong and for 1 week in an intensive seminar in Shanghai. I realized that we weren't just talking about Buddhist traditions, there was a lot of nationalistic discourses at work. And it then became important for me as a person talking about Japanese philosophy in China to look at the larger historical context, which very from the Chinese perspective can be summarized by the Nanjing Massacre. And so I was fortunate enough, my colleague and I we got a grant from the American Academy of Religion to look on ways how the massacre is being remembered, and that has become the basis for the talk and actually a wider work. I'm working with trying to develop strategies for intercultural peace education. What I'm really interested in, or what really has become central to me when I take students to other countries, when I travel myself, being a globalized person, I have at least a foot in four cultures at any given time of the day. And it's what I call unique, inescapable events. And the picture I have here is obviously the mushroom cloud over the first atomic bomb that was dropped in Hiroshima. And for me, those unique, inescapable ruptures are cataclysmic events, catastrophes, that are extremely central, and they're not only central to the history of a culture, of a nation, of a people, but that become a point of no return. And I use the picture here because in some sense the first dropping of the dropping of the first nuclear bomb has become a point of no return for the world community. If you follow the last couple of weeks with North Korea, it's still there. We haven't actually gotten past that. It has shaped the last 50 years of our politics, but also of our thinking as humanity in terms of ethical questions. So I think those points of no return, what I call those unique, inescapable ruptures, are very central to the identity formation. identity formation on multiple levels, from individuals, we all have our different events that shape us, of communities, national communities, religious communities, but also the whole world. And that's again why I choose that picture at that time, because that has global ramification. It doesn't only affect one people, because after that you have the nuclear proliferation, right, in with the Cold War and all that, but you are familiar with that. And what is really interesting here is in a sort of a dialectic is how we deal with those events. Do we remember it or do we deny it? Now, in the case of the nuclear bomb, this I think a few people that denied it actually was Trump. But in other events, when we talk about other events, and those are four examples I have, is some people are denying it. In the case of the Nanjing massacre, there are people who say that it wasn't a massacre, it never happened, it was just a minor war event. Right? Same thing with the Holocaust, there are people who deny that Holocaust. So the question is that how do we deal, what do we remember, and what do we try to forget, sort of invoking a collective amnesia, and what does it say about our values, about our own identity? And so the four examples I have are examples that are really important to me. I'm on the bottom, on the, for me it's the left, it's the right side, is the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And obviously for me as a German, and that is one of those unique inescapable ruptures, right? That is, for me to think about what it means to be a German at this time in the world, at this time in history, I can't avoid it. It shapes my identity, my culture, my ethnic, my national identity. So to have to remember it and to come to terms with that event and what it stands for. If you move to the bottom on the left, is the Wounded Knee Museum. Living in Iowa, I think thinking about the history of us living in America, in the United States of America, our history with the native peoples is central. And the Wounded Knee Museum has become for me a symbol for that. It's in a couple of ways, obviously it's relatively close, it's only 10 hours west of here. If you go on Highway 90, you shouldn't be able to miss it, but that's actually what really struck me the first time I drove west on Highway 90. I don't know how many of you have done that, going into, once you go, you leave Iowa, Minnesota, and going into South Dakota, you see a lot of billboards. You see a billboard about the Corn Palace, there are hundreds of those. You see billboards about the Wall Truck. I never knew what the Wall Truck is. It's a drugstore in a town called Wall. And you have hundreds of those billboards. Wall, by the way, is in the very west of South Dakota. The first billboards are in the very east as soon as you cross into South Dakota. Not a single billboard about Wounded Knee. And that really struck me. The first time I went there was in the late 90s. The first time I saw a sign of Wounded Knee was already in the Pine Ridge Reservation, some 3 or 4 miles before the Wounded Knee site. And it's only in the 2003, 2004, at that time, was that the museum was built with Native American money. So now the last time I've been there, that was 2006, I saw one billboard announcing the Wounded Knee Museum. On top of the left, there's of the atomic dome of Hiroshima, which has become the symbol of the commemoration site, the Peace Park. And on the right, on top, there's a memorial that's barely known. It's a memorial to the Comfort Women. Comfort Women are women that were kidnapped, mostly at the age between 16 and 18, by Japanese Korean women, and then they were used as sex slaves during the Second World War on various bases around the Pacific Rim. And what is really devastating for me is that, first, most people don't know that the museum exists, and that the Comfort Women have no advocate, that they actually, their existence of the problem, of that it actually is an issue, has been denied on all sides, not only by the Japanese, but also by the Allies who won the war, but also by the South Koreans. I don't know what the North Koreans think about it, but my assumption is that they don't really make it a big deal. So those are four examples of what I call unique, inescapable ruptures which are formative to the our identities as individuals, but also more importantly as nations and as the human community. And what is important is how we respond to those. Do we remember them? How do we remember them? Do we try to forget? A key for me to approach the problem is a line, a short excerpt by a play by Max Frisch. The German title is "Nun singen Sie wieder." They are singing again, and I think I have the English on the left side, on the right side, and it's a war scene. The people are in the bunker. There are bombs outside falling, and one woman says, holding a child, says, "I do hope that when the child grows up, it won't remember the war anymore. Then, because then life begins again." And then there's an anonymous voice in the play in the back says, "Well, the next war." And she says, "Why?" And he says, "Because no one remembers it." So that sort of it was the first time I was part of a group that performed it when I was in college, and that really got to me because it, at that point it laid the seed in me what I later came to know to name the ethics of memory, that the way we remember things, how we remember things, what we remember is very crucial to who we are and to our values. And very quickly, since supposed to talk about Buddhism, in Japanese Buddhism there is the notion of the Biwahoshi. Biwahoshis are itinerant monks, and they start in the Kamakura period around the 13th century. And they only played one song. Actually, it's a 6-hour or 8-hour long song, so it's not that simple, but they only play one piece, and that's the piece is to remember the war that led up to the Kamakura period. The so-called Genpei War and the whole second half of the 12th century of Japan. And this is a uniquely Buddhist song. And it starts with, the first line is, "The bell in the monastery, the bell in the monastery garden rings, preaching that everything changes constantly." Then you have a whole narrative, hundreds of pages of people killing each other, and at the end, people end up in the monastery. And the song has been sung as what we would call today ethics of memory, to tell people, don't do that. To point out the in that song, in the Buddhist interpretation, to point out the danger of greed, of egotism, of arrogance that leads to complete destruction. And then, of course, the hidden messages become Buddhist. So that is the Heike Monogatari, a musical commemoration of the Genpei War. Now, ethics of memory is a term that was coined by two thinkers in 2004. Margalit, he actually wrote the book Ethics of Memory, but also Pallas Anderson, who also works on the same issue. And the key from Margalit's book on the ethics of memory, the key definition here is that the difference between dwelling on humiliation and not on recognition is not the same sort of difference between seeing a cup half empty and seeing it half full. The difference, I believe, cuts deeper. Is it not injustice, well, injustice that hurts us into politics? So the idea is that we have to remember those painful parts of our history in order to form ourselves to justice. So that is only the memory of the evil that has been committed that prevents us from repeating it, and ultimately that's the only hope we have towards developing a virtuous or peaceful society. But when we talk about memory, and that is really important, the question arises is, what do we remember? What do we commemorate? Mostly we commemorate happy things. As a person, what do we remember? We remember birthdays, remember anniversary, right? We remember significant events of people. As a nation, we also remember happy events, right? The founding day and things like that. If we remember tragedy, we remember the tragedies that our community suffered. We barely remember tragedies that actually our community has committed. So the question is the two questions is what about the atrocities that are in our history, or the negative things that are in our history, and also the question is what events do we rather forget? And what is really striking to me is what I call Germany's 9/11. It's actually not September 11, it's actually November 9th. We do it the other way around. We start with the date and the month and the year. And when I grew up, November 9th was the memory, the commemoration of the what is called the Reichspogromnacht. It happened in 1938, it was one of the first large-scale violence against the Jewish community within Germany. What was striking to me, what happened in 1989 is that when East Germany opened the borders, they did it exactly on the same day. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's playing with memory, or it's messing with memory. So, hey, now we have a happy day to remember on November 9th. We don't have to go back to the tragic thing anymore. That there's actually a political move at stake, that now we remember something positive and pushing the atrocities that are in our own history to the background. So the big question is what do we forget? And when we talk about memory and commemoration, I think there's always an implied judgment. There are two basic ways of things we remember, right? And that's what I call an extrovert criticism or an introvert criticism. Either we remember things that have been done to us. If we remember things that have been done to us, we also remember the atrocities that have been committed by other people. And then implied here is saying something, we are good, the others are bad. If we remember the atrocities that are committed by our community in the past, we are doing the other way around. We are saying, the other are the victims, the other are good, we are bad. There seems to be a bifurcation here, sort of almost an either-or choice in how we set up commemoration, how we set up individual, national, and human memory, and the identity, the implications that have for identity formation. Do we want to affirm the self? Then we say the other are bad guys, right? Or do we want to be introspective and say we've done evil? Then in return we affirm the others. And the problem with that setup, I think, is an underlying dualistic perspective. And that's when I think we can learn a lot from Buddhism. We can learn a lot from Buddhism for two reasons. The whole project of using memory to overcome suffering is very central to Buddhism. I'll talk about that in a second. And the second reason is the Buddhist tradition provides us with a conceptual structure that helps us break that either-or paradigm. And actually helps us have a different understanding of how to deal with those unique, inescapable ruptures. Buddhism, since it's about compassion, here is the Bodhisattva of compassion, the thousand-armed Kanon Bodhisattva from Japan. Very quickly, the title I gave to my talk is Suffering, Memory, Compassion. This is actually the outline of the Buddhist project. Most of you may be familiar with the very basic Buddhist doctrines. They're summarized by the Four Noble Truths. The first one is there is suffering. And so the Buddhism sees itself in some way as a response to suffering in this world. And if you go into the life of Buddha, Buddha became what we would call a religious person because he saw the three sides of suffering, a sick person, an old person, and a corpse. And his response was he wanted to solve it. He went into the forest to engage in ascetic practices. But the key for him, if you look at the narrative, what happens just before he awakens, becomes a Buddha, before he solves the problem of suffering, is actually memory. If you read the Buddhist scriptures, what Buddha does before he attains awakening, before he solves the problem of suffering, is he sees his own past life and the past life of all people. And those things are very closely connected. And that is the law of karma, Very quickly, I have a picture here, which I a screenshot from a movie called Running on Karma. It's a very actually violent Hong Kong movie that actually explains the concept of karma. And the two people are the main characters. One is the monk who can see karma, and the other one is a police officer. And the pearl, the monk who sees karma, always sees a Japanese soldier in the background. This is actually an image taken right from the images of the Nanjing Massacre. And the idea is that in her past life, she was a Japanese soldier who was did horrible things, and now she, in her this life, she has to pay the consequences for it. So that's the law of karma. So what Buddhism tells us is, first it tells us that life is suffering, it's impermanent, and that we don't have identities, that we are selfless. Now, to understand the way the universe works, the way our lives work, the way suffering is created, we have to first remember. Buddhists call it seeing karma. We have to see our past actions, our past lives, and only when we do that, we also see the past lives of the other people. So in some sense, memory is the key to wisdom, to understanding the way things work. And wisdom is the key to compassion. Those two belong. Those two virtues are inextricably linked in Buddhist philosophy. So that compassion, however, is not an imperative. It's not a moral ought. What it is actually, it is the metaphysical condition of our existence. Once we realize who we are and what we are, we actually cannot but be compassionate. And now it gets tricky. Buddhist philosophy then further says that when we look at reality, when we look at the identities we construct for ourselves, the selves we construct for ourselves, to understand them, we always have to be in the dialectic of two extreme understandings of those. You always have to see that our identities are actually empty. They are constructed. They don't have any real existence. But it doesn't mean that they don't exist, but it means that they are provisional and they're always dependent on specific contexts and conditions. And then Buddhists come up with those really difficult terms like Li Shi Wu Wei, which is translated as the unhindered interpenetration of the principle and the phenomenon. What it actually means is that what we would call that the global dimension, our humanness, or the humanity of every individual, as well as in the individual dimension of our existence, are not two separate things, that they are actually inextricably linked. And that gets me to my own work, which I call the ethics of expression. What the ethics of expression is an understanding of reality that is based on those Buddhist concepts I just introduced. And more specifically, I use the interpretations of this concept by two Japanese philosophers, Kitaro Nishida and Risaku Mutai. And what the worldview they propose is that when we talk about identities, there are actually always three dimensions at play. The dimension is that in one sense, we are individuals. We are unique individuals, constantly changing. On the other hand, we have what Nishida calls universal dimension. You would call it a global dimension. What it means is that each of us are at the same time individual human beings, but we are also human beings, and therefore we reflect or express a common or shared humanity. And there is one world which we all share, there is one humanity which we all express, but we are an infinity of individuals that express that one shared humanity. The problem is, when we talk with those terms, they're both very elusive. Individuality, if individuality is something that is the smallest aspect of us, if it's the present moment, if my individual consciousness, if the consciousness I have at one specific moment. Individuality is always elusive. It always escapes me because the present always escapes me. On the other hand, if I define myself as a humanity, as a human being, and assuming that there are an infinity of humans that express that, then it's, again, the concept becomes a limit function because there are an infinite number of expressions of that. And that is according to Buddhists, the existential ambiguity we have to deal with. And the way we deal with it is we create identities to figure out who we are, because individuality is ever elusive. Humanity is a limit, or being a being, all those concepts are too big, are too universal, and if they become actually truly universal, they become empty. So what we do is we create specific identities, religious identity, national identities, personal identities, subcultural identities. Some may say, I'm a punk, right? Some say, I'm a tennis player. So we give ourselves different kind of identities to make sense of who we are. And that is not a bad thing. The problem is if we take those identities, those specific particular identities, and pretend that they are lasting, that they are actually it, right? If we blow them up to be absolutes. If we take particular identity and don't see them as what they are, namely particular identity in the specific temporal framework, we end up with all those isms, like nationalism, like racism, or exclusivism in one's own religious tradition. So what I say that each particular identity is a full, but it's not a complete expression of the world. What it means is that every individual is necessary to have that complete expression of the world. That means also when we encounter each other, when we encounter different nations, different nationalities, different ethnicities, different religious identity, we all are in some sense incomplete expressions of the shared common humanity. So identities are always particular, they're always in relation to other identities, they're always provisional. I'm teaching at Luther College. Luther College, as the name says, is a Lutheran affiliation. And most students identify themselves as Christians. And when I talk about, and there's the assumption that the term I am a Christian actually refers to something concrete. And I tell them, imagine there's a room of 9 Christian, 1 Buddhist, and 1 Hindu. So the identities you have in the room is that Christians, 1 Hindu, 1 Buddhist. At one point, the Hindu and Buddhist getting tired of being the minority, they leave the room. So you have those 8 Christians left. All of a sudden, they're no longer Christians. They're now 4 Catholics and 4 Protestants. Right? And then they start arguing back and forth, and the Catholics leave. Right? Then all of a sudden, you have 3 Lutherans and 1 Baptist. Again, then the Baptist leaves, and now you only have Lutheran identity. But still, that's not monolithic, because as I found out when I came to Luther College, there are different kinds of Lutheranisms, right? So then you have ELCA, then you have Missouri Synod, then the Missouri Synod person leaves, then you have liberal ELCA, you have conservative ELCA. The point is that our identities are not absolute. They are shape-shifting identities. They are shape-shifting entities, they are temporal, they are always in relation to the other identities we face. That's how we define ourselves. My system here, to explain that is, on the left side, you have the world as conceived from a dualistic or essentialistic perspective. We are just a bunch of people. If you take A out, all the others are still happy. The way I define identities, it's much more what Nishida says, it's on the right side. If you take A out of the whole system collapses. What I think, the way, because of the interconnection of particular identities of individual people, of that common shared humanity, we are all in the same boat, we all need each other, and we have to come to grips, to come to terms with the fact that our identities are constructed in relation and provisional. And this is a big table here. Basically, I'm saying, summarizing what I just talked about, there are two ways of looking at the world, the essentialist ways, where you have essential identities, where you live in isolation, and then you end up with those dichotomies like truth versus false, us versus them. And then ethics becomes an ethics of judgment, because then either we are right or they are right. Either we are moral or they are moral. The model I propose, the ethics of expression, that's based on the Buddhist notion of codependent arising, claims that we still have identities, but they are provisional and in relation. The fundamental paradigm in which we interact is not one of isolation, but one of interconnectedness. And what that reveals to us then is the ambiguity of existence and what I call an ethics of understanding. There's a very quick caveat which I don't have time to get into, and that is that I am aware and I do acknowledge that there's a lot of power differential at work, but that makes the whole system more complicated. So for simplicity's sake, I will stick with that model I just introduced. And now I get to the case of Nanjing. The Nanjing massacre happened in the December of 1937. Japanese first invaded Shanghai and then went west into Nanjing. Nanjing at that time was the capital of China, the Kuomintang. The nationalist government was seated, and they left pretty quickly. And when the Japanese showed up, the picture I have on the left side is a picture of two soldiers who made a bet. And the bet was, who can kill first 100 Chinese with a sword? This is the 20th century. We are not talking about the Middle Ages where people actually were fighting with swords. Machine guns, cannons, air assaults, and their bet was to actually physically kill with a sword 100 people. And since they didn't figure out who was first, they actually went on to 150. And that was the competition that was sort of kept people amused in Japan in that time. So it was on national television, there was in the newspapers. Sort of today it would be a reality television show, but fortunately that didn't exist back then. And the thing is that the Nanjing massacre was actually, it lasted 6 weeks. The Japanese army went crazy. It actually didn't happen in any other city they occupied. The count is that they probably killed 300,000 Chinese in 6 weeks. Incredible number of rapes. That's why it's often called the Rape of Nanjing. And it was immediately forgotten because the Chinese had different problems. Even when the communist government then referred to it after the founding of the PRC as the heroic narrative, it was not until the 90s that actually people started trying to remember what was going on. In the United States or in the English-speaking world, the awareness of the Nanjing massacre was nurtured by a book by Iris Chang, The Rape of Nanking. And she identified so much. Her grandparents were survivors of the Nanking massacre, and she actually became a very tragic figure because she really identified with the victims to the degree that she had physical symptoms of sickness. And she also got hate mail from the Japanese nationalists, and so that she actually was driven into suicide. And it's only then in the 80s and 90s that you have the Memorial Museum, and that has then expanded in 97 and 2007. The next picture is going to be graphic. I think when we talk about things like massacres, to do it from an armchair can be dangerous. So please, I apologize for showing you one graphic slide. Some of those pictures of the atrocities. You have people shot down at the stairs of one of the central buildings in Nanjing. You have just people actually buried into the ground until they died. tied up at a tree and being beheaded. And the person under the picture on the left top is one general teaching his soldiers how to stab Chinese with a bayonet. The controversy, and it was really shocking to me on both sides, it's really hard actually to get historical accounts of what's going on. It's on both sides, the Japan and China, that the story has been used for ideological propaganda. And I got really actually sick and tired of looking at Japanese books. The second from the left is called The 13 Lies about Nanjing. And the Japanese books usually refer to the Nanjing Massacre as Nanjing Event, to make it more palatable, right? They said it was only 50,000, not 300,000. And then blamed the Chinese for inventing it, right? And the last picture is the picture all the way on the left is one of the controversial textbooks. I don't know if you're aware of that. In the early 2000s, Japanese government put out new textbooks, which was immediately criticized by the Koreans and the Chinese because they, we would say, whitewashed some of the, what happened during the Second World War. So the question that arises is that what education does, right? We use books to blind ourselves, to not to listen and to not to speak. What is interesting then, now the way we look at the Nanjing Massacres, there are four kinds of narratives. And I'm picking here four movies, because if you want to, that's a lot easier. It's only 2 hours, you don't have to read a whole book, right? The one on the left side, the right side on top, is called The Black Sun. This is a Chinese movie about the Nanjing Massacre, which is very clearly made for ideological purposes. There's a very clear-cut distinction between the evil Japanese and the Chinese victims. So there's a very clear dichotomy. On the left side on the bottom is a film called John Rabe. John Rabe was a German, and this actually was really interesting. He was a Nazi German who supported, I assume, most of the policies of the German government at that time. He was the head of the Siemens in Nanjing, and when the Japanese started air raids in Nanjing, he first protected his worker and then anyone who came. He actually turned humanitarian. He became the head of the safe international safety zone, and Chinese say that he saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of Chinese because of the special relationship between Japan and Germany. The Japanese army did not interfere with him. That's John Rabe. Then you have on the left side on top Nanjing, which is really interesting. It's a Nanjing massacre through the eyes of Americans and Europeans. And the way it portrays it is, again, evil Japanese, victims Chinese, and Euro-American saviors. So you have an added component, a colonial component. The most interesting film I find is this one. This is a really hard one to watch. If you want to have a relaxing Saturday evening, don't watch that. It's called Nanjing Nanjing, City of Life and Death. It's made by a Chinese filmmaker, and for me, the seal of quality is that it got rejected by both the Japanese and Chinese governments. What that movie does, it looks at the massacre through the eyes of a Japanese soldier. And I was told by Chinese don't make movies from the perspective of Japanese. My response, no, that's what you have to do. Right? And what it does is actually to show us that war destroys everyone. And actually, that the Japanese soldier, that is that picture of the Japanese soldier on the left, is a person sort of get dragged into as someone who becomes a soldier out of idealism and finds himself confronted with a real horror, and he breaks. He's destroyed because of what's going on. So what I have here is those two basic images you have. On the right side is the one you see over and over again. You also saw it in the movie Running on Karma, is the Japanese in the background. So the evil figure, and actually if you watch the movie, The Rape of Nanjing, it's actually a movie about Iris Chang. She says that she has nightmares exactly of that. that happening to her, that the soul should be the soul was following her. And on the left side, you have a Japanese also, the human face. The movie does not apologize, does not excuse anything. It's a really hard movie to watch. But it questions the easy distinction between good guys and bad guys. And I come up here with four ideologies, with four ways of remembering. The first one, which I call primer modern, is a communal or nationalistic approach, which absolutizes those particular national identities. And it invokes nativism, and it creates a feeling of belonging, and then in that sense, commemoration becomes a celebration of one's national identity. On the other side, you have the next category is the modern paradigm, which is universalistic, and tries to not look at it as a national problem, but as a humanitarian issue, but still you have the dichotomy. You have the dichotomy of bad guys, good guys, and bad guys. Then you have the third way, what I call the postmodern way, of looking at dealing with massacres, and that's looking at individuals. That's a human interest story. That's, if you look at the Olympic Games, American coverage of Olympic Games is always the human interest stories, right? Here you have the war being looked at as a personal issue, not as a political, not as a historical, but as a personal approach. That emphasizes the individual aspect. And then you have what I call a post-globalization that realizes that the whole thing is actually much more complex, and that we don't deal with easy dichotomies, we don't deal with good guys versus bad guys, but there's actually our whole fate, our whole destiny as humanity at stake. And what I think is going on is actually is really important. It's that I think that all those four ways of remembering are important, even the national one, because we do have national identities, but we have to realize that there's a limit to them, that they are provisional. I also don't want, and that's why another caveat, I want to very clearly say that I'm not proposing that peace or justice, if you all follow my model, we can get to the point of peace or justice. There are three points. The first one is that I think peace and justice is important, those ideals are infinitely deferred. Secondly, I think that there's always the paradox of revolution, either in political situations, but also when we talk about theories, is if you say that theory is bad, mine is a lot better. I don't know how many of you remember the Who and the famous song, "We won't get fooled again, we won't get fooled again, the new boss becomes the old boss," takes on the same characteristics, right? And ultimately we deal with an existential ambiguity that there is no such thing as a 100% good person and 100% bad person. And this is actually the most difficult thing to deal with, and that's what Buddhists tell us all over again. As long as we are in this world, we suffer. There's no perfection possible in this world. And what I really like, that's actually from an anime called The Records of the Lotus War, it's like the Lord of the Rings, and it's through the eyes of a boy who fights with elves and sorcerers and all that. The last line of the movie is, "There once was a boy who dreamed of being a hero, who believed sincerely in the battle to banish darkness from the world of light. But light and darkness are equal, and where one exists, so too must the other. When the boy realized this, he had taken the first step towards the road of being a hero. So that's the absolute ambiguity. As fantastic as it would be if we could create 100% moral people, it seems to be unrealistic. So what I'm suggesting is a paradigm change that gets away from that either-or logic and that realizes that identities are provisional, that we are interconnected, and that the whole moral agenda is messy, is ambiguous, and difficult. And that gets me to how to remember massacres, and I will keep it on time here. I think there are four ways of remembering, and those four ways are really important. I'll start with the left at the bottom. Those are school books. The image I have is one of the controversial school books, but I do think that education is really important. The last on the top is actually the memorial at the Nanjing Massacre Museum. So memorial is important because they remind us of the dark sides of our communities, of our lives, of humanity. Now the more positive is on the other side, on the bottom of the right, there are three Korean monks, actually two Korean monks and one Korean nun, are performing a ceremony for the victims of the earthquake, the tsunami in 2011 in Japan. And I think this has extremely important symbolic values that you have the Korean monastics out of all to go to Japan and actually break the dichotomy, the tension between those cultures to commemorate the victims in Japan. And the last one on top on the right is Butoh. Butoh is a very difficult dance made in Japan, and Butoh is a dance that deals with the moral and emotional abyss of human existence. The founder of Butoh says, the dancer through Butoh spirit confronts the origin of his fear. So what the Butoh is a dance that confronts oneself with what I call those unique, inescapable ruptures. Butoh was created to deal with the trauma of Hiroshima. And I think Butoh can be used to express all the fears, that emotions, that devastation that the memory of the memory of those tragedies, cataclysmic events evokes. So my last slide here, just in time, is the four forms of commemoration. There's the communal commemoration that creates a feeling of belonging. There is the universal commemoration, it's education, to talk about history, to talk about morality, to talk about justice. There is the witness account. Even though justice is important, even though commemoration is important, we cannot forget the experience of the individuals. And last but not least, there is memory as mimesis. There is the humanistic understanding of an event, of the other person, through enacting it through exercises like, for example, the Butoh. And I think if we combine those four, if we remember what has been done to us and to our, what we and our communities did, if we educate ourselves about history, about philosophy, about morality, talking about the principles of justice, if we listen to the people involved, to the witnesses, to the victims' accounts, and finally if we try to understand the other person and if we try to understand the person, if we try to understand ourselves, I mean, I think that's the way to deal with those tragedies, and that's the way to hopefully work through a more just, more peaceful world. Thank you very much.
You talk about the cataclysms that already have happened. I see climate change is an approaching cataclysm, and I was wondering how your views or your framework would enlighten that discussion, perhaps ameliorate the consequences of most severe climate change.
I completely agree that it's not only those what we do to other directly to other people, but also what we do indirectly by doing it to nature, for example. And the reason why the climate change issue is a lot more difficult is because it's a lot harder to build up an us versus them, because we all in the same, we all are perpetrators, we all are victims, right? We are. This is actually a place where we are both victimizers and victims at the same time. And I think that if it's possible to take events and say those are the events that we remind us of the what we are doing to nature and ultimately to ourselves. I don't know if you take the tsunami of 2011 or other similar events, I think it can work the same way. And what I like about this example is again that the separate distinction between victim and victimizers disappears when we talk about climate change. And there's one phrase I coined that must have been in one of those huge power slides which I went over, is that the key to my system is that through knowing oneself, you understand the other. And I think that especially applies when we talk about climate change, because the same thing that applies to me actually applies to everyone else. So yes, I think that we should include that as well.
You say that all of these four forms together would be the best way to go about this whole process of remembering and understanding. And they all make sense, but is there another example you can give for that memory of myemasis? Because that Bhutto was a really good example, really interesting, but it's just really hard to grasp in terms of this parcel of culture because we don't really have something like that.
That's a very good question, thank you. There are techniques within psychotherapy, but also within mimesis as a hermeneutic discipline that uses the techniques. There are, for example, when you have conflicts, especially in couple therapy, there are certain techniques that say people have to change positions, right? That you actually have to enact the position of the other person. And through that, you then actually understand the person. So that's one way, and the other one is when I was at Temple University, one of my professors was Sam Lockley, who used mimesis as a way to interpret ancient scriptures, especially the Bible. And what he did is had people enact those stories, and through enacting those stories, they actually understood that they thought they were enacting an ancient story from a Greek drama, myth, or from a Bible, but they were enacting. Dramas within the family or within their groups, and through that, enacting those, they actually understood the other person's position. And then I think what that form of memory of mimesis does, that through enactment you understand positions other than your own. And this is really important when we talk about reconciliation, when we talk about justice, when we talk about peace.
I don't know exactly how this fits into your but I'm wondering about forgiveness and on the part of the victim. And it seems to me that there's a relationship between forgiveness and forgetting. Remembering and interfere with forgiveness, and impede forgiveness. I mean, I was thinking of kind of law of diminishing returns. I mean, the problem of Jews dealing with returning back to the Holocaust.
Could you repeat the last sentence? I didn't hear it. Could you repeat the last sentence, please?
The problem of Jews dealing with returning back to the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Looking at it from the perspective of it, is there a way in which remembering can achieve forgiveness and can talk in terms of Jewish principles, perhaps, about how one might forget and forgive?
I'm not sure. Thank you very much for the question. I'm not sure if memory remembering obstructs forgiveness, because memory is not always the same. Right? Even though we remember the same event, the memory actually changes. And I think that actually forgiveness would be part of the process of remembering. And the problem I see with forgetting is that you can say, okay, now we start from the beginning as if nothing has happened. So I think that forgiveness is really important. Firstly, I think is that the victimizers has to do more of the understanding part than the victim. If forgiveness is possible, that would be wonderful, but it has to come from the victim, right? And I think that memory can be actually a catalyst for that. And the reason why I think that is, I don't know if you've heard of Thich Nhat Hanh, he's a Vietnamese monk. He got expelled in 1964, he got expelled from Vietnam for being neutral, because he was neither on the side of the South Vietnamese government nor on the side of the Viet Cong. And in the 80s and 90s, in the 90s, I think, he took American Vietnam vets back to Vietnam. And by remembering together, they actually could forgive. And so I personally, I find, I don't know if that's my historical context, being a German post-war German. I personally find forgetting could could harbor problems. Remembering is remembering without the attachment of the feeling of being victimized may actually be that which then produces forgiveness. So that there are different kinds of remembering, and that if the remembering changes, it creates a space where forgiveness is possible. I don't know if that answers your question. Could you speak up? Within the Buddhist context, I think, again, the way you deal with emotions is to face them. And it's only that you face them is that you can actually live with them. And so through facing anger, you are able to detach from anger at some point. It's a process. And the other terminology Buddhists use is through experience anger, you actually empty it. Because like any emotion, anger is not something permanent. And I think that what can help transform that anger into compassion is this understanding of not only one's position, but of a more general, the wider context of the historical dynamics and whatever. Right? And I mean, that's what Mark Arditz said, that's the definition of ethics of memory, is that it is the hurt that makes us do something. And that's actually, again, the Buddhism starts, the whole Buddhist project starts with the awareness of suffering. If you are happy the way you are, Buddhism is without any significance for you. The same thing if you are content, you're not trying to work towards any transformation. It's only the discontent that actually makes people try to change and improve. So I think anger is actually a positive force, and it should not be avoided, but at one point, the goal would be to transform it into compassion. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, that if compassion is the goal as a virtue, that's where it leads. So if you ask what comes after compassion, that one could say that compassion, if you translate justice into political realities, you have to create laws, right? So you have an unjust situation that creates suffering. through the understanding the suffering, through remembering and understanding, you create wisdom, right? Through that wisdom, you create compassion. It means you change the legal social situation. But as I said before, unfortunately, no legal social situation is perfect. It's whenever you create legal realities, you also create people that are excluded by those legal realities. So then actually in your act of improving something, you're actually creating another suffering, and then the cycle begins. You know, I think that what is really hard is that we all would like solutions. That's why Hollywood movies are great, right? They give you a solution. My students hate Japanese movies because they do not provide solutions. And the problem is, it seems to be the predicament that we don't get to perfection, right? We edge a little bit, hopefully, closer. We make we become more just, but we'll never actually really embody justice. That's an idea I borrowed from Derrida. And that's our problem. Our predicament is one of particularity, is one of imperfection, is one of impermanence. And that's what fascinates me about the sort of the main Buddhist ideas, is that's what Buddhism starts, right? And Buddhism says, our problem, what creates our suffering, is that we are incapable of accepting that. So the acceptance of impermanence, particularity, limitation is our predicament, would be also then the first step towards the healing process. Yeah.
That was terrific, thank you. I wonder if you could make more explicit, or say a little bit more about the relationship between your metaphysics of interdependence and the ethics of memory.
The way I may not I may misread Arshil Margalit at that point. I mean, it seems that the Margalit is still arguing from a dualistic framework. And if you look at the quote, he already sets up those binaries between humiliation and recognition, between justice and injustice, and all that. And what I think, what I hope my ethics of expression is based on the notion of interdependence does is to show that that the dichotomy between recognition and humiliation is actually maybe arbitrary, or maybe not the complete picture, because I think is that if you want to create positive affirmative identities, you can't do that when you reject. The negative aspects, right? You can't have the recognition without humiliation, right? And in formulating that idea, I draw from two sources. The one is Jessica Benjamin. She is a psychotherapist with a rather philosophical bent, dialectical bent, and she criticizes Freud as in saying that independence is the goal of psychological development. She says independence can only work when we are actually dependent on people who recognize our independence. The same thing, I think, that those positive identities, those identities in which we are recognized, can only work if we actually embrace the humiliation, the negative boundaries we set up in our identity. So. And the difference between me and Margalit that I see is that Margalit still works off that those binary systems where I try to use, for lack of a better word, a non-dualistic framework.
I guess the flip side would be to say, what is it about a substance ontology that inhibits an ethics of memory?
I think the substance ontology always comes up with those binaries to say that there's always an us versus them. If you look at the Nanjing massacre at the case, on the first look, it's the Chinese are the good, the Japanese are on the bad, right? Then you step back and say, oh, there were Chinese collaborators, there were Japanese who tried to do something. So it's okay. You make a distinction between the ethical and the unethical process, right? And I think Derrida is correct when he says that when we try to translate justice, an idea which most of us subscribe to, into legal realities, we always create those dichotomies, so we actually never get out of them. So to say that it's possible to have a just person on earth is an illusion. And I mean, you see that when we look at the heroes of our times, like for example Gandhi, then there are people who say, but Gandhi also has dark spots, right? Gandhi did not. Gandhi had a very interesting, let's say, conception of the gender relationships, right? Gandhi was against the abolishment of the caste system. So you could say, hey, he's a bad guy after all, right? And what I'm saying is that my system actually allows to say that Gandhi did incredibly good work. He wasn't perfect. But so we focus on that, on the positive things that he did, and it's not either you are 100% perfect or you are 100% imperfect, right? And I think the problem with the substance ontology is that it lends itself to essentialize and therefore make those essential distinctions and then end up with the, I think that was one of the great gifts of George W. Bush to philosophy, with the axis of evil, right? It's the example of the dualism.
Am I the closer?
Sure.
Thank you all for coming in. Thank you, Mary. Very, very much.
Yeah, thank you again all for coming. And I remind you that our final event of the year is 3 weeks from yesterday, May 7th, Tuesday night, in this room. We have three comparative philosophers of religion reflecting over, comparing over the work that we've done for the whole year. It should be exciting. Please join us for that. Thank you.
It was terrific.
Thank you.
That was really great.
Yeah, that was awesome.
We had a nice turnout too. I've discovered the room.